So the subject I thought I would talk about today is market failure. And I'm going to argue that market failure is a real thing. It is indeed a problem. It doesn't have anything in particular to do with markets, although that's one place where it exists. It is a real argument against the laissez-faire system, but a stronger argument against the alternative to a laissez-faire system. That's the very short version. Many fields, including economics, have technical terms that sound self-explanatory and honest. I am sure there are many people in the world who believe that they understand the theory of relativity, except for the mathematical details. Right? The theory of relativity says things are relative, and I understand that. And as it happens, the theory of relativity does not say that things are relative. In particular, it says that the speed of light is impossibly absolute, as any people, physics students in the audience, probably understand. Similarly, market failure sounds as though it means a situation where markets fail. And that is not what it means, or at least not what I think is the most useful way of using the term. Market failure should be viewed as a situation where individual rationality fails to produce group rationality. Let me give you my favorite example. We are going to imagine it's about 1,000 years ago, and quite a long distance east of here, and you are one of a line of 10,000 men with spears. And your spears are all pointed that way. And the reason they're all pointed that way is there are another 10,000 men on horseback with spears, and they're coming at you. And you do a very quick cost-benefit calculation. And you say to yourself, if all of us stand and keep our spears planted, with luck we can break their charge, and some of us will die, but most of us will live. If we run, horses run faster than we do. I should stand. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him. I just control me. If I run and everybody else stands, one man out of 10,000 isn't going to have much effect on the chance that we'll stop the charge, and I won't be one of the ones killed. If they run and I stand, I'm dead. Whatever the other people are going to do, I am better off running. We all run, most of us die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. All right. This is a class of problems, and it applies in many different contexts. Let me give you a less exotic one that probably most of you have in one context or another experienced. You're in a restaurant or a bar with friends who you're talking with, and it's a little bit noisy. And because it's a little bit noisy, you have to talk a little bit louder so your friends can hear you. And the people at the next table are talking too, but now that you're talking a little bit louder, they've got to talk a little bit louder. And so on and so on. And when it's all over, everybody is talking very loudly and nobody can hear anyone. All right? And that's the same logical problem. That what's going on is that you are making a decision. A sizable part of the cost of that decision is borne by other people. You make the decision because the benefit to you is larger than the cost to you. But it happens that the benefit to all of you together is less than the cost to all of you together. So each of you is better off for his decision, but all of you are worse off for the combined decision. And that, I think, is the useful way of thinking about market failure. Why is it relevant to political issues? Because there is a very simple argument in favor of freedom, which unfortunately, although simple, is wrong. And the simple argument, at least for economists, is that we assume individuals are rational and individuals figure out how to act in their own interest. Well, if I'm acting in my interest and you're acting in your interest and she's acting in her interest, then we ought to be acting in our interest. But that's wrong. And it's wrong because of the problem of market failure. Because if I act in my interest, but that imposes costs on you, and you act in your interest, and that means failing to do something that would provide benefits for me, we as a group are not as well off as we could be if we were all doing something else, if we all stay quiet in the restaurant, if our line of soldiers didn't run away, and so forth. So in that sense, we do not have any guarantee that in a free society where each people first makes decisions for himself, we will be as well off as we could be if everybody made the best possible decision. All right. In some contexts, I pay the cost and you get the benefit. Think about a radio broadcast. I can't control who gets it. That's what economists call a public good. Public good for economists doesn't mean a good the government produces. It means a good such that the producer can't control who gets it, and therefore can't charge individuals for getting it, and therefore may not be able to pay to pay the producer. It may not be in his interest too. So in that case, if I pay the cost and you get the benefit, I may well miss opportunities to do things that would make us all better off. And some of those problems can be solved if you're ingenious. It may have occurred to you that although I've just demonstrated that radio broadcasts never get made, in fact they do get made, and radio broadcasts get made because some unknown genius thought up the idea of producing not one public good but two. One public good has a positive cost of production and a positive value to the consumer, and that's called a radio broadcast. The other public good has a negative cost of production and a negative value to the consumer, and you produce both of them, tie them tightly together, and give away the package. Anyone want to tell me what the second public good is? Yeah? The advertisement, precisely. An ad has a negative cost of production because the company will pay you to put their ads on. Most of us don't enjoy the ads unless they're very clever, but we're always willing to listen to the ads. Right. So that's the case where that particular piece of market failure actually got solved on the market. And there are other examples. For example, you can sometimes solve the problem by putting the two parties affected into a single firm. So if you think about a shopping center or a mall, that having convenient parking provides a benefit for lots of shops. It's moderately inconvenient for each shop to have its own parking, and if they did, it's pretty inefficient because this shop has a lot of customers in the morning and that one in the afternoon. But if you have a mall and the owner of the mall provides free parking, charges rent to the stores, and you can coordinate beyond that. You can realize that people will be more willing to come to a movie theater if there's a late night restaurant next to it where they can eat after the movie. They'll be more willing to come to the late night restaurant if there's a movie theater next to it. So the developer of a mall can try to coordinate the way the mall is developed precisely to take account of the interactions that would otherwise lead to market failure. But again, although you can sometimes do this, there's no particular guarantee that you will always be able to do it. Similarly, of course, for negative externalities, place where my action imposes cost. And it follows from that a sufficiently wise government could make us better off by doing things such as preventing acts whose net effects are negative, preventing a factory from putting sulfur dioxide into the air in those cases where keeping it where a scrubber or a high smokestack would more than pay its cost in terms of reduced air pollution. And a sufficiently wise government could make us better off by subsidizing those activities that produce net benefits but aren't privately worth doing. That's the reason why, in a sense, market failures are a legitimate argument against laissez-faire, against the pure free market system. The problem with that is that we have no particular reason to expect that it will be in the interest of the government actors making these decisions to actually make the right decisions. So if you think about it, it should occur to you that while the market failure situation occasionally exists on the private market, it's the exception, not the norm. That most of the time in a private market context, if I want to produce something, I've got to pay for all the inputs, which means I'm not making my workers worse off just because they're spending 40 hours a week working for me because I've got to pay them the value to them of their time. I'm not making my customers better off by the value of what I produce because I'm charging for it. So the price system, as those of you who have taken a good price theory course could explain in more detail than I am, in effect transmits the costs and the benefits, such that the individual actor in a market system is bearing the cost of his actions receiving the benefit. So if the benefit is larger than the cost for him, it's larger than the cost for us. That's the sort of simple, perfect competition, no externalities picture of how it works. And it's just not a perfectly accurate picture, which is why you sometimes get market failure. But now consider the political market, not imagined as a benevolent, wise, philosopher king making decisions, but it's just like the economic market, a whole bunch of individual actors, each of whom is trying to achieve his own objectives, but under a different set of rules. And you, when you think about it in that way, you discover that market failure, which is the exception on the private market, is the norm on the political market. And let me start with the example which applies to all of you who are old enough to vote. That what I think of as the civics class model of democracy. You ask, why do you expect democracy to work? And the simple model for why you expect democracy to work is the politicians have to do the right things or we'll vote them out. In order for that model to work, the individual voter has to both know what the politician is doing and know what he should be doing. That is not a trivial set of things to know. For some odd reason, candidates never run for election with the slogan, I'm the bad guy. As far as I know, nobody has ever introduced into the U.S. Congress a bill that says, a bill to make farmers richer and city folk poorer. All right, every year we have such a bill. It's called the Farm Program. But that's not the way it's advertised. Naturally enough, politicians being sensible try to make arguments for why pushing up the price of food benefits everybody, which is mostly very dear to ear, but that's the typical effect of the Farm Program. And what about the individual voter? Well, at some expenditure of time and effort, you might be able to make an informed guess as to whether the candidate's good or bad. But what do you get for it? At the level of a presidential election, what you get by figuring out who is the good candidate and who is the bad candidate is an increase by about 1 chance in 5 million of the odds that the right guy will get elected. All right, if you figure this, well, very roughly, I'm sort of giving fuzzy numbers, but roughly speaking, that's the number of votes by which an election goes one way or another with lots of complications. So it isn't worth your putting a whole lot of time and effort into getting information whose benefit is that it increases by 1 chance in 5 million the odds that the better candidate is elected. It's a little, the payoff's a little higher at the state level, still higher at the city level, but even the, if you think about Reno, I don't know what the electorate is in Reno, but I suppose the population of Reno must be, what, something between 100,000 and a million, if I guess not knowing here. So you as a voter still have a chance of much less than 1 in 1,000 that your vote will determine an outcome, and how much effort is it worth going to in order to change it by that kind of amount. I actually spent 7 hours last week sitting in a city council meeting in my city for various reasons, and I'd have to do that a lot of times to really be confident to have an opinion about which city councilor I should vote for. So the result is that almost all voters are rationally ignorant. It is rational to be ignorant when the information costs more than it's worth to you. And the result of that is that most voting is determined by some combination of which candidate looks prettiest, which candidate has the best sound bite, which candidate uses the rhetoric that makes you feel good and warm and nice, which is the candidate your friends and co-workers like, and therefore they'll like you more if you support him too. And very little effect of which is the candidate who's actually doing the best job. How many of you know the name of your congressional representative? I'm just curious. Right. So probably fewer than half. And I guess that most of you are voting age here. And presumably the ones who raise their hand have this odd hobby of following politics. But they aren't doing it as a rational decision to try to control the outcome of government. Because unless they're very, very generous and value benefits to other people. Right, so that's one example of why you would not, in fact, expect democracy to do a very good job of producing the outcome you want. Let me give you another example of market failure in the political market. That people who argue for government doing things often say we need government for long-range planning. Individuals are too short-sighted. And then you think about the actual incentives of a politician. And imagine you are president, and there is something you can do that will be politically costly now, will involve spending money that you could use to buy votes, but it'll make a really good effect 20 years from now. 20 years from now, it will make the country a better place. 20 years from now, you will be long out of office. The odds are roughly 50% that the other party will be in power. And if there are good effects, the president who's then in power will get the payoff from those effects. If you look at how elections go, economic conditions at the time of the election have a sizable effect. And if you look at what politicians actually worry about, it's the prediction of what will the unemployment rate be at the next election, what will the inflation rate be at the next election, and so forth. So from the standpoint of the individual politician, except to the extent that he is very benevolent, it does not pay him to bear current costs for future benefits. On the other hand, firms quite routinely and individuals quite routinely bear costs for benefits 20 years in the future. Anybody who saves for his retirement obviously is doing that, and firms make investments, some of which have short-term payoffs and some of which have long-term payoffs. So we would expect that the political system would have short-time horizons, not long-time horizons. And there's a good economic reason for that. Suppose you are considering planting black walnut. Earth's pretty kind of lumber, but it's a hardwood tree and it grows rather slowly. And you say, well, I've got some land, and if I plant it with black walnut trees, in 40 years, they're going to be very valuable. Unfortunately, I'm 70 years old. And it looks as though it would not pay me to plant those trees. But that's wrong. Because 10 years from now, I can find somebody who'd like to invest in black walnut trees with only 30 years to wait, sell the land to him. If 30 years is too long for him, in another 10 or 20 years, he can sell it to somebody else. So you can, in fact, make investments beyond your own lifetime due to the fact that we have secure property rights and can therefore transfer something partly developed to somebody else. That doesn't work if you have insecure property rights. If you believe that each year there's a sizable chance that some enterprising person will come onto your little forest with a jeep and a chainsaw and go off with your half-grown black walnut trees, the higher that chance is, the higher the return would have to be on your investment since when it works to make it pay off. And the same thing is true if you believe that there's a sizable chance each year that some enterprising politician will decide that black walnut trees are a national resource and therefore should be nationalized. So what you need in order to have long-term planning is secure property rights. And politicians do not have secure property rights. As I used to put it a couple of presidents ago, Clinton could rent out the White House, but he couldn't sell it. That what a politician has is political power. He can't simply transfer that in the same kind of way you can a bunch of black walnut trees. And therefore, it's rational that politicians are generally quite short-run in their views. Let me give you another example. Let's think about drug regulation, medical drug regulation. You are an FDA regulator. There is a new medical drug. There is some chance, maybe a very small chance, that will have lethal side effects. Side effects that take long enough or occur under some special circumstances such that they haven't yet been detected. If you approve the drug and it turns out to have lethal side effects, your career is finished. Right? How about if you say, well, you've got to test it some more? The effect of that is almost certainly lethal. I'm assuming that it's a drug which is actually some improvement on some existing drug. So the result of the bringing the drug onto the market is that some disease cure rate goes up from 80% to 85%. Therefore, keeping that drug off the market is killing 5% of the sufferers, roughly speaking, each year. But those are invisible deaths. Those are statistical deaths. No way of knowing who are the people who would have lived with this treatment and don't live with the older treatment. So as a sensible person, you are willing to stall for a long time in approving that drug because the cost to your career of going slowly or very low, of going rapidly, is a high risk. And I like to illustrate that by referring to the press release quite a while back when the FDA confessed to killing 100,000 people. For some reason, that's not the way they wrote the press release. What they said was that they had decided to approve a medical drug for a new use, the use being as a beta blocker to prevent a second heart attack. And they estimated that this use would save 8,000 to 10,000 lives a year. Beta blockers had been in use elsewhere in the world, in particular in Europe, I think for more than 10 years by that time. They were not in common use in the U.S. because the FDA wouldn't approve them. So what the FDA was saying was that by being, this was not, I should say, a dangerous drug, because the drug was already used for other purposes. The question was whether this was that their decision had killed about 100,000 people. But that doesn't get them fired. All right. So those are all examples, but let me keep going on my examples. Think about the incentives of people who make the law. The law in our system is made by legislators and by judges. All right, judges interpreting the law are really, to some degree, making it, and legislators are explicitly making it. Imagine that a judge sets a legal pressure to reduce the income of the country, the real product of the country, by 100%. Or a legislator passes a law that reduces the income of the country by 101%. That's an invisibly small effect. He will never know. Try multiplying 0.01% by the GNP of the U.S. and ask how large an amount of damage that is for a single person. All right? 0.1% gives you a factor of 1,000. What's the GNP anymore? It's about 6 trillion, 7 trillion, something, 8 trillion, something like that. Let me guess it's 8 trillion, I don't remember. So from 8 trillion, you get down to 8 billion, one more factor of 10, that's somebody who has wiped out $100 million a year. All right? Now, 1/10 of 1% is probably still large for a single law, but I think it makes the point that you can make mistakes that are very large in human terms and yet are invisible both to you, to the voters, to the people who you care about, and so forth. So the conclusion that I'm arguing for is that market failure exists on the private market. That on the private market is an exception, but not a rare exception. Minor forms of market failure happen all around us. For example, if you choose to, I don't know if any of you share the odd superstition that my wife has that certain colors don't go with each other. But if you choose to wear clothes that clash with each other from the view of people who have this view, you are imposing costs on all the bystanders, and some people do in fact do this. If, on the other hand, you go to a good deal of trouble to look so in such a way that your presence makes the scenery more attractive, you are providing benefits to the bystanders. We ignore all of those. We just say, well, in the perfect world, I don't do it. So small levels of market failure are very common. I think large levels are not very common, but they still exist. But on the political market, since market failure is coming from cases where the person making a decision is not bearing the net benefit, net costs of that decision or receiving the net benefit, on the political market, almost no decision maker, whether voter, judge, regulator, or legislator, bears any significant fraction of the cost of his decision, or for that matter, receives any significant fraction of the benefits of his decision. We would therefore expect market failure to be the norm on the political market. And that's a reason why I want to claim that market failure is a stronger argument against political interference in the market than it is an argument for it. That shifting authority from the private market to government is more likely to increase the problem of market failure than it is to decrease it. And you will notice that the one essential assumption I'm making is that the same people are playing on both markets. The assumption I'm making is that when thinking about the political system, you want to think about it the same way you think about the ordinary economic market. Not in terms of what can benevolent, wise rulers do, but if all the players in the game are acting the same way they act in the private market, that doesn't mean you're purely selfish. People care about some other people as well, but most of us care a whole lot more about ourselves and those close to us than about the anonymous population of the world. Most of us have some cost of gathering information. If you make all of those same assumptions for the political market, you conclude that the political market is much more seriously messed up by the problem of market failure than is the problem. Now, I want to go on to point out that market failure, I've been discussing it in the political context, but in fact it's relevant to a whole lot of other things.
My first example had to do with an army rally. So if you try to imagine you're actually trying to win battles, what you want to think about is, how do you leverage the other side's individual rationality to make them lose, and how do you leverage your side's individual rationality to make you win? So for instance, there is a very ancient solution to the problem of an army running away. It's proverbial, in fact. It's called burning your bridges behind you. You march your army across a bridge, the last guys over burn the bridge, and you then point out to your people there's nowhere to run, you had better stop that charge. A somewhat more brutal solution to this is the last row of people in the army are the ones who kill anybody who runs. We read in American history, in the sort of history books, which as in most countries are biased in our favor, about how in the American Revolution the stupid British marched around in neat formations with uniforms with lots of buttons down the middle of the uniforms, while the clever and brave Americans shot them down from behind stone walls and things like that. This is the same British army that beat Napoleon about a generation later. He won the great general of history. And my view is that the English didn't indeed lose, but there were reasons for those formations and those uniforms. A nice, bright uniform with buttons down the middle makes it really hard to run away and hide. A nice, tidy formation means if you start running away, the other people on your side see it and do something to you. So my guess is, and I'm not an expert on 18th century military history, my guess is that they were sensibly, given the constraints they were facing, running their own. Let me give you another example, because another solution to the problem of armies running away is to set things up so the individual soldier cares a whole lot about the lives of people immediately around them. So you therefore want to encourage the kind of group cohesion in which your buddies matter to you, in which your honor, your respect matters to you. And there is, it happens, a very famous ancient historical case of this. And that was the sacred band of thieves. This is in classical antiquity, Greece. And there was a military unit that was made up of pairs of homosexual lovers, no one of whom would ever show cowardice in the presence of his beloved. And the sacred band won every battle they fought until the last, when they encountered a Macedonian army commanded by Philip of Macedon and his son Alexander, later known as Alexander the Great, and he died to a man. So that's one solution. So let me go on to some less grim examples. Because I also want to suggest that another name for a market failure is a profit opportunity. That is, if there is a market, that means that if you could find a way of solving it, there would be net benefits there. And if you were clever about solving it, you would pocket some of those net benefits. So I mentioned the example of whoever it was who thought about the odds of combining ads with radio programs. Let me give you another example. There was a firm, I suppose a decade or so back, which said, we would like to provide people online with the ability of finding stuff. How could we get paid for telling people how to find stuff? It's really hard to collect very small payments online. So charging people 2 cents for doing a search doesn't work. But how about if we give away the ability to find people and we sell the ability to be found? And that, of course, is the Google market strategy, that you have a free search engine, which I suspect practically everybody in this room uses, certainly I do, and then you charge companies. It's not like you don't pay anything you can't be found, but if you do pay something, you're one of the ones that appears, of course, at the top on the right-hand side, that's the way they are set up at the moment, when people search for things that are relevant to what you're doing. So that would be a case where you have a potential market failure, namely a search engine is really useful, there's no good way of charging for it, and a clever person finds out a solution to that one. Let me give you another example from my team. This is something I haven't done. I don't know if anybody else has. But there's a problem that you will discover if you're ever a teacher, which I refer to as the silent student problem. And the problem is that I'm teaching an economics course, and I'm explaining an idea that I've explained 100 times before and have known since I was 18 years old or 19 years old or something.
Perfectly obvious to me.
Finish explaining it, and I then said, now, is there anybody who didn't follow my explanation of the principle of comparative advantage? And nobody says anything. And so I go on, and only when I grade the exam do I find out the mistake I've made. What is happening? You are a student in that classroom, and you say to yourself, well, I don't understand it. Maybe the other ones do. If I say I don't understand it, I'm going to look stupid to my fellow students. I don't like that happening. I'll look stupid to the professor, and maybe he'll be less willing when he grades the exam to give credit for my guesses. So I'll just prudently keep my mouth shut. Everybody does that. My solution, I have a technological solution, which is I haven't actually implemented. And my technological solution is you have a classroom where at every place there's a button on the floor that you can unobtrusively push with your toe without anybody seeing. And at the back of the classroom, there's a sign that shows how many buttons are pushed. So I say, will everybody who clearly understood the principle of comparative advantage, please push your button. And the number 3 appears on the screen in back, and I go back and explain. So that's another case of engineering around market failure. And it's a useful concept, I think. And if you're running a firm, of course, a firm, especially a firm of any significant size, have all sorts of potential internal problems of market failure, ways in which one division can do things that benefit another division, but not it. And you then have to figure out in structuring it how you come as close as possible to setting it up so that you can measure how good a job each part of the firm is doing and thus properly reward the people who do a good job and punish the ones who don't. Let me finally give you my favorite example of a favorite example of designing around market failure. And this is a story set in the Arabian Desert. Two Bedouins are riding their camels through the desert with the oasis a couple of miles away. And they happen to be close to each other. And one of them starts talking about a dreadful camel he has. He says, this camel, if it is a camel, I think it's a very large snail, has got to be the slowest beast in all the deserts of Arabia. And the other one says, huh, you think your camel is slow? Mine is more like a rock. Well, they get into an argument about whose camel is slower. And they finally agree on a bet. Whichever's camel gets to the oasis last will win the bet. That shows he's the slower camel. And the other Bedouin will have to pay his owner 2 golden dinars. Well, you can imagine what happens. They start towards the oasis, and one goes slowly, and the other one goes more slowly, and the first one goes more slowly, so they both want to win the bet. And an hour later, there are 2 Bedouins sitting there, camels stock still in the blazing sun, in the middle of the Arabian Desert, with the oasis still a mile away. At this point, a wise man comes walking by, and he says, why are you 2 idiots sitting here, camels stock still in the middle of the Arabian Desert in a blazing sun, with the oasis a mile away? And the 2 Bedouins get off their camels to explain the problem. And he says 2 words to them, and they leap back up on the camels and ride off for the oasis as fast as ever they can. What is the 2 words? Which camels? Right? Each one gets on the other's camel, that reverses the incentive, and solves the problem. So that's sort of a neat example where a very small tweak in the situation suddenly eliminates the form of market failure that was causing the problem. All right, that's what I wanted to say. That's my talk on market failure. I hope you enjoyed it. I will be happy to take questions. If you want more of my stuff, I do have a webpage with a whole lot of articles and some books on it, all for free. The internet is a moderately clumsy technology for selling information, but a beautiful technology for giving information away. And if people want to discuss the economics of how it pays to give information away, I can talk about that too. So davidgfriedman.com, and that also has a link to my blog. All right. Thank you.
I got a question in regards to, you're talking about the walnut tree situation.
Yes.
What is your perspective on patents and sort of copyright things where the net benefit of the property might be overbearing to the market?
Yeah, that is, intellectual property is an attempt to solve a market failure problem, and it's not entirely clear if it makes things better or worse. That is, the basic idea is that I create a piece of intellectual property, it is costly to create, it is cheap to copy, that if we don't have intellectual property, much of the benefit of my creating it goes to other people, therefore it doesn't pay me to create it, therefore it doesn't get created. That's the basic doctrine. It's worth noting, however, that this way of putting it is a little bit strong because it implies, among other things, that Shakespeare's plays weren't written, since the first British copyright statute is, I think, 18th century, a couple of hundred years after, 150 years after, or so after Shakespeare. So there clearly are ways of getting rewarded that may or may not be adequate. And the problem in the other direction is that when you have intellectual property law, first, patents are the hardest case, because a patent is trying to draw a line around an idea, that ideas are very fuzzy things with fuzzy boundaries. And that means, if you think more generally about where property rights do or don't work well. And property rights work well if it's fairly easy to define the property, if it's easy to detect trespass, if it's easy for potential trespassers to know if they're trespassing. They work very badly in a situation where boundaries are fuzzy, where the trespasser doesn't know he's trespassing, where maybe you don't know he's trespassing, or it's costly to find out. So if you think about the patent situation, the existence of patents has the advantage of giving an incentive to investing, but the disadvantage that anybody else who's inventing things has got to make an expensive patent search to make sure that what he is inventing is not covered by your patent. And even if he finds your patent, it may be very unclear whether it's covered, because what he's got is not exactly your idea, is it a version of your idea, and so forth. So I guess all I can really say is that patents are a way of solving a market failure problem. They're also a way which creates market failure problems. And when you get your patent, you don't bear the cost of other people having new patent searches for their own research. So I don't think there's a clean answer to that. I think the arguments for copyright are somewhat stronger than for patents. Well, the arguments for traditional copyright, for prohibiting you from copying my book, are stronger because you're not going to do it by accident. And it used to be the case that if you did it, I could find out what you'd be publishing and I could sue your publisher. It's getting much harder to enforce copyright now because online you can infringe my copyright at very low cost. I may not know who you are and so forth. But I think traditional copyright with traditional technology was a pretty defensible form of intellectual property. Patent is more easy. If you're interested in it, there is a book whose title is Against Intellectual Monopoly, I believe. And the authors, true to their principles, have put it up on the web so you can read it for free. And it argues against both patents and copyrights. And the authors of that argue that, in fact, they claim empirically patent law has slowed progress, not speeded it. And they give some evidence. I'm not sure they're right, but it's at least interesting to see a counter to the sort of orthodox view which they're the opposite.
So would you consider yourself more against patents?
I would say that I am the exception to the observation that all libertarians know the correct answer to the IP question. Half of them believe that intellectual property is the most defensible form of property, and half of them believe it's the least defensible. I don't know.
Hi, I'm doing the recession. And what do you think,
Mark? Market
going on a grand scale like recession. What do you think would be the best way to solve recession or get the market back to
To do that, I would first have to know why it happened. It's my view, at least, that a course in macroeconomics, which is not what I do, is a tour of either a cemetery or a construction site. That we don't really, let me put it differently, if we really knew the answer to these questions, we wouldn't be having recessions anymore. People thought, when Keynes wrote, basically, he thought that he knew the answer to the question. In 1960s, the sort of where the orthodoxy was a fairly simple version of Keynesianism, the majority opinion among economists knew the answer. And it turned out they were wrong, since the policies were followed and they did not produce the predicted results, which is the test of a scientific theory.
So I would have to say, you know, I can make some guesses, but they're very much uninformed guesses. The macro is not my field, and I don't really trust anybody who is certain that he knows the answers to macro questions. Okay?
Thank you. I'm more focusing on, like, the Great Depression and what could have been done.
Why do you think the Great Depression happened?
I think that the Federal Reserve buggered it up, basically.
Yeah, that's a possible explanation. It may well be a correct explanation. But then one question is there really the right answer that there should have been a Federal Reserve that did better things, or that the Federal Reserve shouldn't have existed in order that banks would have the incentive to take the precautions that would prevent the runs on the banks that crashed the money supply that arguably created the Great Depression?
So that just goes into moral hazard, basically, right?
And the problem of getting government to do the right thing.
Thank you. Freeman, you said some really amazing things about power markets and political incentives, and how the promise of government is that civil servants don't have incentives, but in realistically...
They do have incentives, they just have the right incentives.
They don't have the right incentives.
Yeah.
And I think the collectivists of the future are going to say, You don't need to have freedom because you can defer that to something that's impartial. You can defer it to the algorithm. And the algorithm will determine, you know, it doesn't have any incentive.
But who has the incentive to write the algorithm?
Exactly.
And who has the incentive to seek the algorithm?
So how do we make arguments against the collectivism?
That the first point is that so far, at least, computers aren't even close to capable. If you really think of what's involved in a planned economy, you not only have several hundred million people and a huge number of goods. Every good, one bushel of wheat is not the same as every other bushel. They're in different places. They came ripe at different times. So you really are talking, I mean, there were people early on when people had sort of the ideas of linear algebra and that kind of stuff. It looked as though maybe you could solve the equation. And then maybe with some future computer, but I think I'm very dubious about you being able to do it. Let me put it differently. All societies face the coordination problem. The coordination problem is that to get anything substantial done, you need the cooperation of a very large number of people. The sort of standard famous example is making a pencil. To make a pencil, you need wood. To have wood, you need chainsaws. To have chainsaws, you need steel and copper and gasoline to run them. For each of those things, you need a whole bunch more input. So if you think it through, making that pencil involves some millions of people cooperating. And then the problem is, how do you get them to do it? How do you arrange that enough coal is mined to make enough steel, to make just the number of chainsaws you need, to cut down just the amount of wood to make the right number of pencils, multiplied through everything? And there are two solutions to that problem, one of which doesn't work. And the obvious solution is the central control, which is really what your imaginary computer is doing. The obvious solution is somebody at the top figures out what should be done and tells people to do it. And that works for very small groups. For a football team, maybe that works, or for a small company. But it doesn't scale. That's why the Soviet Union crashed, basically. And the other alternative, which is the one I've really been implicitly talking about, is some decentralized system where you split the problem up in such a way that each person solves a little tiny bit of it. And then the problem is giving him the right incentives, that's what I've been talking about, making sure that when I solve my bit, I have the right incentives, which means I'm bearing the net cost. That's what I've been talking about so far. That does scale. That's why big societies actually work.
Is that a blockchain? And that sounds exactly like...
There's a blockchain is one approach to doing, but I'm just thinking of ordinary private markets are a way of doing that. Yeah. No, I should say, by the way, the other problem with your computer is there's information it needs. That the information that goes into solving the centralized solution is itself distributed information. They have to know how much you dislike working on Saturday, because that's relevant to whether they should allocate you to the Saturday shift or the Friday shift. They have to know what time you like getting up. They have to know how much you prefer chocolate ice cream over vanilla ice cream. Well, that information shows up in the decentralized one, in what people got to pay you to work on the weekend, on what ice cream you choose to buy at what price, but they have to somehow get all that information and feed it into the computer. That's going to be very hard to do.
Bail over market. What? Because we don't know necessarily what our government is doing over what it ought to do, and because the time horizon is going to be very long.
Those are among the reasons. But the
general reason is because we don't have institutions in which government actors, which includes the voters, have typically bear the net cost of action. But the way to make a decentralized system work, and the political system is really decentralized if you think about it down to the level of individual elections. The way to make a decentralized system work is to set it up so that each individual actor bears the net cost of his action. And we can never do that perfectly. The market comes pretty close to doing that, and as far as we know, there's no political system which does the equivalent. So that's the general reason, and the examples I was giving were particular applications of it.
I was more thinking about local government, like a local market failure, like a local dog catcher. I would be willing to pay maybe $1 for a dog catcher, but no one would be willing to catch dogs for a living for $1.
Mm-hmm.
So since it's a dog catcher, we know what he ought to be doing. We can easily see if he's doing that.
I'm not sure you really know what he ought to be doing, because what about the point when somebody complains that you caught my pet who was just running around my wife's front yard who you thought was a dangerous dog? I mean, think about the number of cases where cops shoot a perfectly harmless dog because they come into the wrong house because they think it's the house where drugs are being sold and they got the address wrong. So there are, you can do things wrong even with dog catching.
Well, I mean, the dog shouldn't have been the name, but... I get how you could do it wrong, but there's the problem of...
You're asking more generally the problem of how do we deal with problems of market failure on the private market. And in that particular one, the obvious way of dealing with that is a proprietary community. So you have a developer who buys enough land so that he can set up 50 houses. And when he sells the houses to customers, part of the deal is that you agree to be a member of the community association that's associated with this little development. That community association, you agree, you will pay dues of $200 a year to it, and you will then, with a group much smaller than even the city, with a group of 50 voters or so, 100 voters or couples or something, to vote on how that money is spent, and a dog catcher, part-time dog catcher with 50 families, can then be hired to do that. So that would be one of the market solutions. But the other thing is some problems don't get solved. Right? It's not like there is no guarantee, the world gives us no guarantee that all things worth doing will be done. All we can do is find the least bad way of solving problems.
The least bad way.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. All right, I had another question. What is your perspective on the economy as it stands today and sort of the moral hazards you see in the market and things that might cause problems in the future that you see today?
I don't think of economics as a study of the economy. So the answer is it's not really a question that a lot of thought about. It's pretty obvious that the medical system is a mess. It's a mess in the sense that, particularly a mess now with Obamacare, because Obamacare forced adverse selection, if you're familiar with the idea of adverse selection, let's say. If adverse selection is what happens when you have a transaction between two people, one of whom has the relevant information, the other one doesn't. So the classic example is the used car market. There's an article called The Market for Lemons, and it's not about lemons, it's about cars. And the idea in that market, you're probably familiar with it, is that the seller knows whether the car is a lemon or a cream puff. The buyer doesn't know. The seller, lemons sell at the same price because the buyers can't distinguish. At that price, if you have a lemon you want to sell it, if you have a cream puff, you don't. So most of the cars that are sold are lemons. Buyers recognizing that are only willing to offer you a lemon price. So now none of the green puffs sell or almost none of the green puffs sell. And you've got a whole bunch of cars where the buyer would rather have the seller, but there's no way of doing the transaction. In the medical market, some of that's unavoidable because you, as somebody buying medical insurance, probably know some things about yourself there's no way that the seller can find. But since Obamacare says that even things that you and they know they're not allowed to price on, that they are required to charge you too much and me too little, because we know that young people are much less likely to have medical care, the medical costs than old people, but there is a limit to the ratio of the two prices they're allowed to charge. They are required to sell it at the same price to somebody who knows and who they know has a medical problem will be expensive as to somebody who doesn't, so that's generating adverse selection and messing up that market. In addition to which, for various reasons I don't fully understand, a lot of people buy medical insurance covering things that aren't really insurance because they're covering routine small payments rather than just rare large payments that insurance is normally designed for. That means you have an inadequate incentive to not use the doctor when it's not worth using, and so forth and so on. There are a lot of problems in that case, and there are a lot of other problems associated with government regulation of various sorts. I'm not sure I know of any really serious problems at the moment associated with the absence of government regulation. There certainly could be one. That if global warming is really a serious problem, which I'm inclined to think it probably isn't, but I could be wrong, then that would be one where the lack of regulation would lead to serious difficulties. And pollution in general is potentially such a problem.
Could you say, like, under situations of pollution, if you had a... If there's always an owner of something, essentially, if there's the right structure to arbitrate between people, like if the government owns the property, like pollution, like the streams and stuff in between, couldn't the government sue, like in a free market, couldn't the government sue the person polluting the property?
How does the U.S. sue people in Canada and people in Canada sue the U.S., and why would people in Canada be willing to have their government let us do them? I mean, there are lots of problems for large... If you have very short distance things, you can do it. But once you get diffuse effects, also you're assuming now a government that wants to do the right thing. But why don't we just say, well, look, you made good contributions to my campaign last year, so you, clearly your pollution is in the public interest. It's just too costly to prevent it. Whereas here, well, I hate to hear to the other side, so we're going to... And well, there's lots of problems getting government.
That's a problem with the politicians, but in terms of if you're an owner...
But you were having the government as the owner that was doing the suing.
Yeah, well, maybe I described it wrong. Not the, you know, the...
Right.
The way it's structured today.
I understand. So you can think of the tort system as a sort of a first-order patch on a set of market failure problems. But it's not a very good patch because the damages are being determined by a court, not by a market process. And it works very poorly in the case of diffuse costs. And it doesn't know anything about diffuse benefits. I can't say, unless I'm the government, I can't say I gave you a benefit, I will now sue you and make you pay me for it. What taxes in some sense are. So it doesn't really provide a solution on the other side, the positive rather than negative.
Okay.
Okay.
My question is, disregarding for a moment the incentive to do so, or in quote, as a lack of the incentive to do so, do you believe that the return to the gold standard is possible? And if it were, would there be any
It is possible. I don't think it's the optimal solution. In my view, to begin with, when you say the gold standard, it sounds like you're assuming that the government has something to do with the money. I mean, that's the first mistake. I mean, there's no particular reason why money should be a function even of each of us are the traditional limited government, that when Adam Smith was writing, the Scottish money was being provided by Scottish private banks. So my own view is that the optimal monetary system is multiple private issuers, probably a fractional reserve system with a commodity base, and the commodity base could be gold, but the reasons that made gold a good money 500 years ago don't really apply very well anymore. That gold was a good money for two reasons. First, it has a high value to weight, so you can have coins that aren't too big that are valuable. And second, it is pretty easy to distinguish gold from anything else, even with not very modern technology, because gold at the time was the densest of all metals. So if you just check the density, and if it's half gold and half silver, it's going to have a lower density. So it's, let alone gold-plated copper or something. So that made a good deal of sense. But in a modern system, almost certainly what you're going to have circulating are not actual coins, but pieces of paper that represent the ownership of coins or the ownership of assets. Well, if what's circulating is a piece of paper for the ownership of a ton of steel doesn't weigh any more than a piece of paper for the ownership of an ounce of gold. And the advantage, what I would regard as the ideal system, I'm not sure you can get it, would be what's referred to as a commodity bundle system, in which what my bank says is if you bring $1,000,000 in, I will give you half a ton of grade X steel and an ounce of gold, and claim to 14 gallons of petroleum and claim to 17 bushels of wheat, some bundle of commodities where I've chosen the bundle of commodities to represent a crude price index so that they represent some kind of a rough measure of average cost for the society. And that means that you're going to have stable prices happening automatically, because if I issue too many dollars and the result is that the value of the dollar drops below the value of that commodity bundle, then people will put together a million Friedman dollars, come ask for their bundle, probably more than a million, so do it in large quantities. I give them the bundle, they sell it on the market for more than a million Friedman dollars, and repeat. Well, what's happening? Friedman dollars are flowing into my hand. I can't get people to take it because they're not willing to take it at the price that I'm charging, which is the thing you have to buy for that. So if you have if the issuer is willing to freely transfer in both directions, this is the way of keeping a token coinage at a constant value that was discovered in, I don't know, the 17th century or so, you can then have a token coinage which purchasing power is almost perfectly stable because of the way you set it up. So that would be my time on the ideal system. And you do it with the fractional reserve system, meaning that my bank doesn't actually have a million tons of steel sitting in their vault. They've got just enough of the resources of the things so that when somebody comes in, they can hand it to them. And then they go and buy some more of them out on the market. So they have to have other assets, obviously. But that would be my preferred system. A gold standard, I don't know if it's better or worse than we now have. But the basic trouble with the gold standard is that gold is going to have somewhat unstable prices due to both monetary and non-monetary demand. So if you imagine circumstances of suppose you have economic growth and for some reason not much gold is being mined. In that case, you're going to have prices in gold falling, the value of gold going up. That's not a horrible thing to happen, but it means that you're making long-term contracts in that currency. You don't know what's going to be worth when the contract is coming. Going the other way, if they find I think it was my father's line that William Jennings Bryan was killed by cyanide. Why? Because Bryan's political career depended on the fact that gold was a deflationary metal. That farmers were having a hard time paying back their mortgages because the price of wheat and gold was going down. The two things happened. One of them was the discovery of the South African gold field, and the other was the cyanide process for extracting gold from low-grade ore. Gold became an inflationary metal. Right? So those are reasons why gold is not ideal. It might be better than government fiat money, depending on how good a job the government does on handling the fiat money. I mean, the worst fiat money cases are much worse than that, of course. Anyway.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
I thought I really enjoyed reading about Law as a Common Good on your website and all your other sources you have, so it's great for everybody to check those out.
Yeah, the website's got all sorts of fun stuff.
Lots of free stuff on it.
It's got several books. It's got a book on law and economics. It's got my substitute for a econ course in the form of a book called Hidden Order, and it's got lots of articles. Some of them are libertarian articles, some of them are economic articles. One of my hobbies is cooking from very old cookbooks, so if you'd like some 10th century Middle Eastern recipes, I've got them, or 13th to 14th, 15th. I guess maybe the European ones are mostly 14th and 15th century. I like to refer to 16th century cooking as Nouvelle Cuisine.
Hey, Simon. So my question was, I actually went to the Young American Civil Liberty National Convention.
Yeah.
I was tweeted at to get to your question, but I was a little too late in my thinking. But you had mentioned, so he basically was at the convention arguing for anarchy versus minarchy, which Austin Peterson was arguing the platform for. And he had brought up, that there had been, you asked the question, you say a lot of minarchists don't ask the question, is minarchy even possible? So when they say, you know, anarchy is worse than minarchy, is minarchy even possible to maintain? So you had brought up that there are multiple societies in the past that were anarchists.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask, what were those societies?
Sure.
Briefly, how did they function? And then why don't they exist today?
To begin with, one of the things on my webpage is the draft of a book which I'm trying to find a publisher for at the moment, which is called Legal Systems Very Different from Ours. And it comes out of a seminar I taught every other year at Santa Clara University Law School for a fair while. and it looks at, I think, 14 different legal systems. That the underlying idea of the book is that all human societies face about the same problems, that they solve them in an interesting variety of different ways, and that they're all grown up. So we should put all of them seriously. Among those is the one that first got me interested a long time ago, and that's Saga Period Iceland. And that's what I think of as a semi-stateless society, because they had a court system, a legislature, a law code, and no executive arm of government. So prosecution and enforcement were entirely private. So that would be one interesting example. And that was a society where the basic structure was there was a sort of a franchise system in which there were about 40 people whose title was Godi, which is people usually translate as chiefdom, but that's really misleading because they're really in tribes. What the Godi was the person through whom you plugged into the legal system. So if you were an Icelandic farmer, you chose one of the Godar, which is sort of a Godi, to be your Godi. If somebody sued you, what court he sued you in was determined by who, the same way that what state you're a citizen of will affect how you get sued in our system, what Godi you're a Sigmund of would in theirs. And you are free to change from one Godi to another if another one will have you with some limitation. So that was one system. Another system, I have a long chapter on that one. Another one that I have a chapter on is Northern Somalia, Somaliland. And that's a system which was entirely stateless for quite a long period of time. We don't know how long. And that's a system in which, you go back a step. The term I've been using for a collection of these systems is feud law. And what I mean by feud law is a system in which law enforcement is private and decentralized, and which the basic rule is, if you wrong me, I threaten to harm you unless you compensate me. And there are a set of conditions that it has to meet to be a workable system. I've got a chapter running through those conditions on the legal system as well. First one is there's got to be some way in which my threat to harm you is believable if you did wrong me and not if you didn't. So it's not just extortion. And there are various ways in which these different societies have solved that. There then has to be a way of making me carry out my threat, because you, of course, will say, if you harm me, I'll harm you. So you've got to have a commitment mechanism. Then you have to have a way of protecting the weak, a way in which people who don't have large resources, lots of allies and friends, who are willing to fight for them and such, can nonetheless get their rights protected. And my favorite example of the solution to that problem is Icelandic, because in Iceland, the claim you got when somebody wronged you was a marketable claim. So I'm an elderly man with one son, and somebody killed my son. And in principle, he owes me 200 ounces of silver as wear and tear, the damages for killing him. But I know perfectly well that if I try to sue him, I'll get beaten up on the way to the court, to the open-air courthouse. However, my neighbor is a wealthy farmer with four tough sons and went a Viking in their youth and lots of friends and relatives, so I transfer my claim to him. He now wants to collect the 200 ounces of silver. Maybe he splits it with me, maybe he doesn't, depending how hard it is to collect. But the result is that the guy who killed my son suffers the penalty for having done it. So that was sort of a clever way. And I've argued that in our court system, which is a partly private system, because in court law, although the enforcement is by the government, the prosecution is by the victim, or the victim's lawyer, that our court system, there would be much to be said for making tort claims marketable. If you imagine somebody smashes your car, maybe you can't afford a lawyer. Maybe you can't afford a lawyer because it's the best lawyer. So you auction off your claim. The high bidder is going to be a law firm that will do the best job of collecting on the claim. You now have the money, and the guy who smashed your car ends up paying. So I like to say that in that respect, American law is a mere 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology. So that would be an example. Another example, a rather less attractive society, is the Comanche Indians. The Comanche Indians were a stateless society. A war chief was simply an entrepreneur. A war chief was somebody who said, I'm getting up a war party to go raid the Mexicans and see if we can steal some horses and get some slaves. Who'll come along? If you come along, you're under the orders of the war chief until the raid is over, but you can leave at any point. He has no special position, no right to collect taxes or anything of that sort. So that was a system where there was no... Okay. Wasn't particularly pleasant, especially for their neighbors.
but what the system in which there was no, nothing we recognize as a government, yet it functioned for a fairly long period of time. Those are some of the examples of that system. But if you look at my legal system, it's very different. You can see the few systems I discussed are the Icelandic, the Somali, a number of different Romani systems, the people who are often called Gypsies, in particular the British Romani, the Romanichal, who have what I have today, what I like to describe as a primitive version of the Icelandic system, less formal, with the same basic logic to it. The American Romani, who at least as of 40 years ago, had their own weird version of the feud system, in which the way you fight with people is not with swords, but by accusing them to the authorities of a crime they have or haven't committed, and thus getting them into trouble. And you drop the accusation once they settle, once they pay you what they owe you, what you think they owe you, so forth. So I discuss a bunch of those. But I discuss a bunch of other systems as well. The book isn't about stateless systems, it's about legal systems different from ours. And the first one I start with is Imperial China. About 2008.
So stateless systems end just like all other kinds of systems end. So just that they end alone, it wouldn't be a reason to argue against them.
Just that
stateless societies have ended in the past,
yes,
would not alone.
Yes. The Icelandic system lasted for about a third of a millennium. So it did better than we have done so far, than for the American system. The last 50 years were pretty bad. On the other hand, we got into a civil war less than a century after our system was established, and their civil war took 250 years before they got into it. It's hard to tell how bad it was or wasn't. Part of the fun of Iceland is the word saga derives from histories and historical novels that are set in Iceland in the 10th, mostly in the 10th and early 11th century, were written down in Iceland in the 13th and 14th century. So you're getting a sort of a first-hand picture of that society by people who lived there. It's a late version of it. They're readable. If you want to, I like to argue that saga period Iceland competes with Heraclean Athens and Shakespearean Elizabethan England for the title of the highest ratio of literary output per capita in history, because I would guess that there are probably at least a dozen of the sagas currently in print in English paperback translations. And that's from a population of about 60,000 people living in a 5-point
country. Thank you.
So this is my first kind of event here with you guys and people. But every time I come to one of these situations,
I tend to compare it to probably the most disastrous economic event of my lifetime and pretty much everyone here's lifetime, which is the 08 crash. And so we talked a lot in the last two questions, and I didn't know about these when I was writing this question, in regards to how disreformed government and disreformed regulation could solve these. But basically the question I'm posing on you is, for our democratic society, you talked about how individual politicians don't necessarily have a short-term benefit to create law. So that's why we can kind of draw a linear line of deregulation from the outcome of the 40s and the Great Depression to deregulation in the late 1990s.
Great Depression was in the 30s.
Yeah, sorry, 30s to the 90s ending with Glass-Steagall and then the creation of huge massive banks and the fall of the economy when we didn't necessarily know what a loan was anymore as individuals. So how would kind of your ideal solution to this be, because we didn't necessarily get a perfect solution from our government.
But to answer that question, I would have to have a better idea than I do of why the recession happened.
Okay.
As I say, macro is not what I do, and I have not seen any clear and unambiguous account of different people think they know the answer.
Yeah.
But I don't see any particular reason to be confident which of them is right. And so that makes it very hard for me to answer. There are certainly things governments can do that make it more or less likely. And in particular, a situation in which the government says, if you go broke, we will prop you up, give companies less of an incentive to avoid going broke. That's what's called moral hazard. So that's one thing that can affect it. And in the particular case of the crash you're describing, arguably it starts with the real estate market. Dominant players in the real estate market are two government-created enterprises called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Both of those were nominally private, but people believed, it turned out correctly, that if they went bankrupt, the government would save them, and that reduced the incentive to be careful about making sure you didn't loan money to people who couldn't pay it back. But whether that's the really real reason, I don't know. I'm just pointing out that there are possible explanations in which the cause of it was something government was doing. There are probably possible explanations in which it wasn't.
So then let's narrow it down to the idea of then incentivizing these sort of banks to be a little bit more responsible with our money.
If you tell a bank and the stockholders or owners of the bank that if you go broke, you go broke, if you lose the money, then they have an incentive to avoid losing the money. If what you say to them is, if you go broke, we'll bail you out, then they have an incentive to take somewhat riskier but higher return gamble on the grounds that if we win, we get the money, and if we lose, the taxpayers pay the money. So that's sort of the fairly obvious way you try to reduce that problem.
Yeah, I guess the question is, what is the my opinion is during that sort of specific instance, similarly to the 1930s, there was no guarantee necessarily that we as a public would bail out these institutions.
I think in the case at least of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, there was no legal guarantee, but there was a correct belief by people that we would, and in fact we did.
Okay.
So that was a case in which they had been created by the government, did not formally belong to the government, did not have a legal right to collect taxes, but in fact the situation was such that if they crashed, it was likely that you would not be correct that the taxpayers would bail them out.
Okay. Just as a personal question, do you think that was a good idea?
No, I don't think they should have been created in the first place.
Okay.
That is, I think the government shouldn't have been involved in the mortgage market at all.
Okay.
Hi, Dr. Friedman. I was waiting for somebody to ask a non-economic related question, and I'm going to go back to this. You seem to kind of, to my imperfect knowledge, you seem to kind of be in your own anarchist tradition, because there's like the one group which is stemming from like Rothbard, and then there's the group which traces back to like Lysander Spooner, Benjamin Tucker, even like incorporating like Proudhon and more like mutualists or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think I somewhat know your opinion on the former, but I don't so much know your opinion on the latter. So I was wondering
I like Spooner. He writes well. He makes some interesting points. I think that group of people does not understand economics very well. That in particular, they seem to think that somehow there was something inherently wrong with interest, which I don't think is correct. The No Treaty in the Constitution, No Authority is a neat little book. I enjoyed reading it when I first read it a very long time ago. I would have said that I'm in the same category as Rothbard in the sense that we are both in favor of private market, capitalist, stateless societies, and that there are two differences between us. One of them, which certainly is between me and many libertarians, I'm not certain if it's true of Rothbard, I think it is that many people want to argue it in terms of sort of a priori moral rights, in terms of natural rights. And while I certainly have many of those moral intuitions, I don't think I can do a good job of showing that my moral beliefs are correct, and therefore I don't want to try to base my political arguments on them. I think I can do a decent job of showing my economic views are correct. I believe it is the case that most people have enough in common of what they consider desirable so that the institutions I'm in favor of, if they work, probably are better by the standards most people have than the alternative institutions. That therefore I don't have to persuade them that my moral views are right, I only have to persuade them that economic views are right. And certainly many libertarians don't take that line of argument, although they presumably also believe that their system is better for everybody or almost everybody. So the other point on which I disagree with Rothbard is that as far as I can tell, Rothbard imagines that the legal system of a market anarchist society will be generated by legal philosophers who persuade everybody to agree with the correct philosophical view, whereas I view the legal system of such society as itself a market product. It is that set of legal rules that the private courts find in their interest to use, and I claim to have economic arguments that show that that will tend to produce
those legal rules that maximize human welfare, and furthermore, that those legal rules that maximize human welfare will be reasonably close to the rules of the Libertarian Third Day Club. But from my standpoint, the claim that anarcho-capitalism is libertarian is a theorem to be shown, not a definition.
All right. I have a question in regards to, there's been a lot of socialists and communists becoming popular again among college campuses. It's really hard for, you know, free market or libertarian people to, you know, explain to these kind of people. It's really hard to get a message out there. And then, you know, it's hard to explain, you know, information like this to people. And it's hard to compete against, like, a socialist who wants to promise, you know, somebody something for free, versus us explaining why that won't work. Mm-hmm. How would you best describe, or what do you think is the going forward, how the libertarians will, like, move forward with our message, or how we would, you know, move forward?
But, I mean, the answer is different people in different ways. But if you're a really good novelist, which Ayn Rand was, for example, mm-hmm. you write a novel which embeds the ideas you want to spread. My guess is that it's a mistake to write a novel whose main purpose is that, although that's part of what Rand was doing, which is pretty exceptional, because if the readers see it as you're preaching at them, then the reason I've written a number of novels, but I have not tried to make my novel cases for libertarianism, in part because it's too easy to cheat, that you, the author, are controlling what happens so you can make the good guys win. But I do try to have novels where ideas come through in the novel, as it were. And that's one thing you can do if that's what you're good at. If you're good at writing songs, you can write songs that have the ideas. If you think you can get a lot of publicity running for a political office that you're sure you won't win, that's one way. That's what Ron Paul did, elected to Congress. He didn't get elected president. But that's one way of getting ideas out. Arguing individually is another way of getting ideas out. Arguing online is another way. It's not like there's a single solution, because different people have different talents and ought to be doing different things. But in my view, one of the reasons why political movements, ours as well as lots of others, have so much infighting is that people imagine that there's a right answer, and if you're pursuing the wrong answer, you're wasting our resources that should be used pursuing my right answer. And that's a mistake. Because if I persuade you that the right thing to do is to run for office, and you just hate running for office, the result is that your labor ceases to be a libertarian resource. You just won't contribute it. But it might be a libertarian resource if it consisted of writing op-eds or letters to the editor or, you know, doing some other activities you enjoy doing and are good at. So I think in that sense that I'm in favor of decentralized attempts to change the world, not centralized.
So I watched your talk today when you were in Budapest, and
yep.
you were again talking about the fume box systems and all yep. that. And I my heart wants to like agree and, you know, embrace it, but I have the problem of it seems like you need a group of people who generally agree on the principles that are being enforced. Mm-hmm. And so I have talked to the people in the club and have the mm-hmm. concern that, say, either it could be through immigration or cultural shifts mm. or political shifts, like where communism in the 1900s yeah. and now Islam today is a big debate point. How can we ensure that in a stateless society that these cultural beliefs of, you know, statelessness yeah. or what we're enforcing in those systems, how can we ensure that those will be...
We can't ensure it. But let me give you a scrap of evidence that this is a better system for handling those problems, not a worse system. And this is Icelandic history. Iceland changed religion twice. All right, conflict between religions is the kind of thing they're thinking about. The first time, it was from paganism to Christianity. That in the late 10th century, Norway went pagan. Iceland had been mostly settled from Norway, and there were fairly close ties between them. And the king of Norway started trying to pressure the Icelanders to go Christian. Things like seizing Icelandic ships in Norwegian ports unless the crew would agree to the church and so forth. And some Icelandic Christians either converted in Iceland or converted in Norway and came back to Iceland, and there was a certain amount of conflict, but the people were killed, and eventually the Althing, the annual assembly, was held, and both sides came to the assembly ready to fight, and they declared themselves out of war with each other. They announced that, in effect, they were now two countries on the same island.
cooler heads prevailed. They decided to accept arbitration. The pagan law speaker was chosen by both sides to be the arbitrator. He arbitrated in favor of Iceland being officially Christian with toleration for private but not public pagan worship, and it was all over. Maybe 10 people got killed. I don't know if that counts, doesn't it? About 600 years later, roughly, Iceland is no longer under the kind of system I'm describing. It is now under the King of Denmark, standard sort of royal system. And Denmark goes Lutheran. And Denmark imposes Lutheranism on Iceland, and it takes, if I got it correctly, something like 50 years of violence, and quite a large number of people are killed. So that's at least one case which looks as though the decentralized system handles this kind of very fundamental disagreement somewhat better, not worse. Now, I'm sure it doesn't prove anything. It's a tiny, tiny sample, but it is sort of interesting. And I would have said that in general, if you can violate people's rights for free, you often want to do so if they're doing something you don't like. If the cost of violating people's rights is, in effect, outbidding them when they're trying to bid for getting their rights protected, you're much less likely to do so. And you've got much more of an incentive to find the kind of thing the Icelanders did, namely compromises that aren't too bad for you and aren't too bad for them, because they won't bear large costs trying to get their legal rules if the ones you offer them are pretty close, and you won't similarly. So I guess that would be the short answer. My first book is Machinery of Freedom, and the second edition you can get for free from my webpage. The third edition, I think, is $2.99 at Kindle, maybe $3.99, I'm not sure. There's a printed version a little more than that. And part three of that was where I sketched initially what such a society might look like. And I do discuss basically the mechanisms by which legal rules are getting generated in a market stateless society. And part of it, of course, is that not everybody's under the same legal rules. That you can't have exactly what you want because the legal rule between me and you has to be the same as the legal rule between you and me, right? So I can't completely control it. On the other hand, if there is a group of people who agree on something, they can arrange the legal rules between them or the ones they want, and then some different rules when they're interacting with other people. So that makes it less of a potential problem than a political system where you have to have the same rules for everyone.
Yeah. So like you were mentioning with because I'm in the candidate in Christian pagan, but the kind of the switch from Christian to pagan and so on, you could see it coming, with Rome and then Charlemagne, and it just kind of steamrolled through. When these kind of shifts are happening, say it was that they knew this problem was going to be where there was going to have to be a clash between the two, and in this case it resulted in one cannot do it publicly, the other one's going to kind of recognize.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a way a stateless society could get this, the kind of the system we have in America, where there is public worship for anybody? Do you think a stateless society could do that, or do you think there has to be
a
slight repression?
It depends on how strongly each side feels.
Sure.
If you have a majority, a Christian majority, where everybody in that majority thinks it's just dreadful that anybody should be a Muslim, then you've got a real problem. Get out for the Muslims. But of course, historically, it isn't even the Muslim position. If you actually look at how society, traditional societies that were run by Muslims were run, they had toleration for at least Christianity and Judaism. In the case of the Mughal Empire, most of the time for Hinduism as well. And in the case of Persia, most of the time for Zoroastrianism, though that varied some. And they essentially had a system, even in those societies, where Christians dealing with Christians were doing it under Christian law, Jews dealing with Jews under Jewish law. So it was certainly not a perfectly tolerant society, but it was a society where there was a majority religion which allowed freedom of religion within certain bounds and not equality of religion. And so I don't see why you couldn't have, in a modern society where I don't think there is a majority of Americans who really object to other people being Muslim, and I don't think that we're not going to have a majority of Muslims, but I don't think if we had a majority of Muslims in a stateless society, it's not clear why they would feel strongly that everybody had any Muslims.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Earlier you brought up Ayn Rand.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask your perspective on her and objection.
I think Ayn Rand was a brilliant, courageous, arrogant, somewhat nutty lady. I think the fundamental claim of objectivism, I think, is false. It's a very interesting claim. the David Hume argued a long time ago that there was no way of solving the Islam problem. There was no way of going from the facts of reality to moral conclusions. Rand thought there was. Rand claimed, that I think it's pretty clearly explicit or implicit in Rand's writing, is that from the facts of reality you can deduce what people ought to do. And if you look at the third edition of Machinery of Freedom, which is one of the new chapters, I attempt to take apart that argument. I attempt to show that the argument she offers that doesn't in fact work, that it's full of holes. So in that sense, philosophically, I am not an objectivist. I do not find objectivism convincing. I am an admirer of Rand. I think she was a very odd writer, but a very good odd writer. There was one television interview of hers where somebody said, you know, Miss Rand, people say you are not in the mainstream of American literature. And she replied with her Russian accent, the mainstream of American literature is a stagnant swamp. So a neat lady, but that doesn't mean she's right. I mean, there are lots of people who I admire who are wrong.